CliffCentral.com.
That is correct. Yaku joins us this morning for another episode of Unbundled with Catalytic. And really, if you are talking connectivity, cloud security, all of that stuff, this is a show you need to listen to. Also, during that break, in case you missed it, George and the Auto Central podcast, very, very cool Auto Trader podcast, they were talking about whether you could add these things to your fuel to give you more mileage. And the answer will be revealed on that podcast. So go and listen to it. It's available on Cliff Central or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, you know, Apple, wherever, all of them. We tick all the boxes for you. So we want to hear from you this morning. We want to know what you're up to. And obviously, we're going to try our best to avoid talking about load shedding, to avoid talking about the petrol price increase, even though we know these are the things that are affecting most of our lives and pissing most of us off on a daily basis. We've got to just soldier on. I mean, what else are we going to do? Like, you know, there are all these protests, this shutdown that people are talking about, but that's not going to help. That's going to make it worse. We've got to just get on with it. I know the president at the FU Real story is over, but I see it as an opportunity for members of the general public to lure him in and use it as a platform to explain how useless this government is. Yeah, I don't know, Vyasan. I mean, the fact is, I think that the ANC and the president, they're in such a state of panic and disarray at the moment that they actually just aren't even paying attention to ordinary people or their problems. And really, when something like this Enyo Benny Tavern thing comes along, I think they're just doing what politicians have always done. Knee-jerk reaction, let me make it look like I care, get out there. They're trying to do what looks like the right thing. And they just don't have any new ideas. The politicians have no new ideas. And they certainly don't have solutions. They're not good at solving problems. If anybody in South Africa is still laboring under the misconception that we have leaders who can fix things, like if you complain and you go, oh, well, Eskom or the petrol price, the government must, then you're living in like 20 years ago. You know, you're living in the era of Thabo Mbeki, who actually had his hands on the controls and knew what he was doing, had formidable people in his cabinet who could make things happen. Do you remember during the Thabo Mbeki administration, which feels like ages ago, we were running at a surplus? We didn't have debt as a country. We actually had money in the bank as a country. We had, I think we had 6% growth, and even higher than that at some point. But like during Thabo's administration, we had up to 6% or more in growth. Now we're looking at a exactly the opposite. We're going backwards by like 6%. It's insane, you know, and this has all happened since Thabo was taken out. And I saw him on TV the other day. It was his birthday. Thabo Mbeki turned 80. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, he still looks pretty damn good. I mean, I know people joke about how much he drinks. And, you know, there are some people who've been on the show who've said that he definitely, they can vouch for the fact that he hits that drink hard. Even before the sun goes down. But I still would rather have him, even at his drunkest, at the controls than any of the people we've got there at the moment, honestly. And I was one of the people who said when they went to Polokwane for that conference, like, it's time for Thabo to go. God, how I eat my words every single day. I was wrong. Yeah.
I think what we are seeing is leaders that are completely disconnected with the people. It's like Nassim Teta with the 2 million rand flag.
Remember
and
that?
He saw absolutely nothing wrong with it. It was like,
flag.
Dude.
Yeah.
Like, dude, do you know what state this country is in? Do you know what your people are going through? What you're suggesting right now? And he's just like, yeah, a glow-in-the-dark flag, basically. And it's like, dude,
we don't even have electricity at that point.
Like, so when our politicians are very disconnected with their people, the solutions are always going to be like, but dude, this doesn't make sense. Like, make this make sense, because it doesn't make sense for anyone. And I think that's the biggest issue, but
I'd love to just plug people in who could solve these problems. But also, you know, as so many of our Burning Platform guests have said, including Pumi, my co-host, she said the solution's not going to come from other people. Sadly, it's going to have to come from us. So I think we've got to start looking to ourselves. Anyway, The rand was 6 rand to the dollar during Thabo Mbeki. And we got rid of him for a cloud.
What a tie.
Yeah, Sanele pointing that out. Yes. Oh, please, Thabo was riding the wave of the world believing in the new South Africa. Yes, but John, they did believe in the new South Africa at that stage. So did we. And that's why we were moving forward. Our attitude was good. We were like, yes, we're one of the best countries in the world. We're moving in the right direction. And therefore, we moved in the right direction. You know, the attitude comes before anything else. And we had a good attitude about ourselves. And since then, I'm afraid it's gone the opposite way. Ah, man. Apparently, the ANC is going to court this week to challenge all the findings against CADA deployment. Now, I wonder what their argument's going to be, because that just sounds like the dumbest idea ever. But let them waste their money. Or rather, hang on, let them waste more of our money. No.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And then they're going to just charge us more in taxes so that they can, you know, spend more money in brunches, lunches, you know.
We live in a country where the solution to everything is just charge them more taxes.
Yeah.
And we're being taxed out of our asses at this point.
Dude.
Yeah.
Dude.
Mm-hmm.
And before they even text you, they need a lunch to have a discussion on how they're going to move forward. So therefore, we must pay for that lunch. Mm-hmm. It's just a big scam. If we had to name a scam,
that's
name
it.
South Africa. Right. It's a scam.
So, all right, let's talk about some other things, because there are other things going on in the world. And we've got Anne Bickard, who will be joining us in a little while. When you borrow someone's money, you might need to, at this point, because of the cost of petrol and everything else, you might need to borrow money from a friend. How much is acceptable? Mash wants to know, because if you lend a friend money, if you're the one who's the bank and you're giving someone money because they've said to you, hey, I just need to pay some medical bills, or I need to buy this because, you know, I'm underwater for this amount of money, or I need to pay off my car because this is happening. Otherwise, I don't have a job anymore. You know, people have got real pressure on them at the moment. And if you are in a position where, let's say, you've got some money in the bank, I mean, I don't know how many people in South Africa can say that at the moment, but if you have some money in the bank and a friend, a really good friend, says to you, hey, listen, I need your help, how much is appropriate? Now, obviously, depends on how much you've got, because if you've got lots, you can lend lots. If you don't have a lot, then obviously you know, even if you have the best intention in the world, the kindest heart in the world, and you believe your friend will pay you back, doesn't matter because you can't lend money you don't have. How much is appropriate here? And also, how do you do this without it becoming an issue? Because we all know stories about friends who've not paid us back, people who've ripped us off, people who said, oh, you know, I just need this, please help me, and I swear next month, end of the month, I'll pay you back. We all know what happens. A lot of people, even though they're not horrible people, they just can't manage money and they end up taking yours, and it dissolves the friendship. It ruins the friendship. How do you handle this stuff?
Yes, because it's an ongoing thing. And I mean, as you mentioned, Gareth, that we are going through tough times. Everybody's going through it at the moment.
Definitely.
On different levels, of course. But either way, so sometimes you just have friends asking for money. And the thing is, sometimes it's difficult to say no, depending on the level of friendship you are at with this person. So what I need to find out is exactly, firstly, how do you go about it? How do you go about it? And secondly, where to cap it at? Because as you also mentioned, that we're not all in similar tax brackets. Mm. So some people can actually afford to give you your 10 grand, some people can't, but there has to be a cap. And that cap, well, I was thinking, should be actually an amount that you can give to a person and write off if they were not to pay you back. That's what I had in mind, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to look at it. For me personally, I'm not the richest person, and I do have like a cap to say, if anybody asks me for money, A, I always ask, what are you using the money for? There's certain things that I do not want to enable you in. So if you feel like you need to party or buy sneakers or whatnot, those sneakers can wait. You do not need it. But if it's something serious like petrol and you need to get to work, or there was an unexpected expense, your tire blew up or something, hey, if I have the means, I will help you. I then also have a cap to say, I'm not borrowing my friends more than 1,000 rand. Like, because I feel like if you can't pay that money back, I can write it off. Anything above 1,000 rand, I need that money back. Like, I really, really do. So for me, and also the relationship, you have some people that feel like because I know you, I can now ask you for money. No, no, no. Who are you in my life? Like, that's also the thing. Some people just want to party and then they get arrested. Hi, Superior, can you please bail me out of jail?
Has that happened to you? Have you been asked? Have you been asked for bail money?
No, no, not me. But I do have a friend who was called at 2 a.m. in the morning to bail out somebody when they went gallivanting, enjoying their lives. They didn't even invite him. They didn't say, hey, would you like to come out for drinks with us? No. And 2 a.m., they're like, please, can you bail us out? And it was like, no.
Wow.
So I think that's, you need to look at the relationship and look at who are you in my life. If you're an acquaintance, then, hey, me saying I can't help you, you should understand, even if I have the money. Because I might look like I got money, but that money is for me and not for you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it what makes it even more complicated in terms of friendships, depending on how close you are, is that thing of, do you know how humiliating it is having to ask someone for your money back? Having to ask them, actually plead with them, like, please, I need this money. Please give me my money back. And they get angry at you.
Yeah, they're like, I'll pay back. Yes, okay, so but it's just 200 rand that I need back.
I've had two different situations. There was a time probably about 10 years ago where a friend of mine, she was going through a really, really tough spot. She was a good friend of mine. I knew she was good for it. But I gave her the money and I just kind of forgot about it. I was like, you know what? I don't expect you to pay me back because it's just a gift. That way you clear your conscience. You're like, I'm giving you this money. If I never get it back, that's fine. It's not going to affect our friendship because I've pretty much written it off anyway. We're still friends. We've never spoken about it ever since. I've never asked her for the money. She's never offered to repay it. It's just not a thing. And I see her and it's all good. I mean, like, I'm okay with it because I had written it off, right? I decided this is not something I expect to see back. And it was really just me doing a good thing for her. It wasn't about like a transaction. It wasn't recorded and like, you know, you owe me this when, and it wasn't small money. It wasn't like, you know, 50,000 rand, but it wasn't 5,000 rand. So it was quite a lot. And then the other kind is like where someone sends you one of those messages. They're like, hey, I just really need your help. The next month is going to be really tough, but I promise I'll pay you back. And those people, I'm always like, I just don't really have the money, especially if they're not good friends of yours.
Yeah.
Because even if I did, and I really don't, like, I don't think anybody's got like plenty of cash lying around at the moment. You just know it's going to be a thing. And you're never going to be friends with them again. In fact, you'll be better friends if you say no to them than if you lend them the money. Because then after that, they're going to be so embarrassed when they don't pay you back that you're not going to be able to be friends anymore.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, with some people, depending on the level of desperateness they're at, actually determines whether or not you will get your money back. And what I mean by that is some people are just asking you for money to pay someone else.
Right. Right, because they...
That's crazy. Like,
yeah, because they owe everybody money.
Wait, so
yeah.
I borrow money from Gareth, and then to pay him back, I come to you, Mesh. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, you come to me, yeah. Because now Gareth is getting impatient. It's been 3 months. And you're like, oh, let me just borrow from Mesh to pay Gareth. At least now I have 3 months leeway with Mesh here.
Yeah.
It happens all the time.
That is a very good point.
I've witnessed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the friend of mine who's actually busy borrowing money and all of that, he's sketchy like that. He's very sketchy. He's a very odd character. We don't know what he's using this money for. He already owes the friend of mine money to begin with. And he's just so sketchy. We don't know if he's drinking or what exactly he needs this money for. But also his stories keep changing. It was, hey, this my mother, my father, my sister, my aunt. And it's like,
There's always some sob story and, you know, medical bills or like somebody, you need to bury somebody because they died and there's no money for the funeral. And
yes.
Stop right there, let me tell you something. The first time, I understand. The second and third time, they're just taking advantage of you being a nice person. Because I truly believe that if they had the intention to pay you back, they would have communicated that. But B, they see that they can leech off you. If I keep asking you, Mesh, hey, can I have 500 rand? And you give me. And you don't ask for your 500 back, whatever. 3 months passes, can I have another 500? And you just give. Bruh, you my new ATM. You Correct. Are definitely the person that I'm going to. You're going to give me money, and I can. And you're not even holding me accountable to say, okay, what are you using this money on? Instead of me, you know, paying, giving you money to pay for the funeral, let me go deposit that directly to the service provider.
Well, also, you know, there are two other things that need to be said here. So Tracy says, if you lend to a friend, you should always have a contract. Also, expect. Once money and a contract enter a friendship, it may be the end of that friendship. Now, sometimes, if you really want to get rid of someone, lend them some money because you'll never see them again, right? So if someone is a problem in your life and you've had enough of them and they're always asking for things, give them some money. But understand that that's the price you're going to pay to never see them again. And sometimes it's worth it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that money is well spent. I love this from Dogozo. I'm actually offended by someone who asks me for cash. It's such a horrible feeling and just messes up my budget. Well, I don't know if you could actually sit down and draw up a contract with somebody. Some people manage to do this. And I think, you know, if you are strict about it and you actually get someone to like witness it and all that stuff, then you're really tying them to a contract. And that's quite good. But then again, you may never be able to rebuild the friendship after that, because honestly, the moment business and friendship mix, there are either very good things that can happen or very, very bad things and nothing in between. It's very complicated. Mm. Celeste says, I had a friend who leached 5,000 rand out of me with a sad, sad story. 5 years later, she isn't my friend anymore. Worse, I lost my job when COVID hit and she's still not bothered to pay back the money.
Oh, no.
Terrible.
Yes.
Terrible. I mean, one piece of advice I got from a friend was always take collateral. If the amount is over a certain amount, let's say 1,000 rand, take something as collateral. Take their fridge, take their TV, take something.
That sounds so gangster.
Have you done that?
It sounds like I borrowed money from a machinista and they're like, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm here to collect. You don't have my money. It's fine. Where's that laptop?
Yes. But no, but Cynthia, are you serious? That is the only way. You want to borrow 1,000 rand? Bring that
Mash.
Phone.
Mash, you're bring joking. Have you done that before?
No, a friend of mine told me to do that going forward. And that's what I'm going to start doing to people. So you better have something of value.
So Mash is actually short for Mashonisa. Jeez. Yeah, yeah, yeah. See, propaganda agrees with you. Just ask them for a deposit, their TV or something that you can use. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you don't pay me back, I sell your TV, I make my 1,000 rand back. Simple as that.
All right.
Oh, that's hectic.
I don't disagree. Hey, you know what? I don't disagree. I think that makes a lot of sense because if they can do without their TV because they need the money that badly, then you know what it is. That's a good idea. Mm. Yeah, become a pawn shop, says Beth. If they don't like it, they can go and pawn shit themselves if they're that broke.
Absolutely.
Stone Philosopher says, Mash has found his gravy train. Parallel Parking says, I'm with Mash. MM says, I'm in court suing a friend over money. The friend is an extremely close friend. Yeah, listen, when it gets to court, then you know it's really gone badly. And it's usually a lot of money, too. Because otherwise, why would you be paying the lawyers a lot of money? It's got to be a fortune that was lent. The MM, good luck. Harmin says, the other thing that is never talked about is interest on the amount that you borrowed. It becomes a thing when you borrowed someone, or you lent someone in this case, a large amount of money. Yeah, you know, like friends who charge interest, that's complicated. That is complicated. Listen. I have to tell you, I'm not comfortable with borrowing money. I'm not good at it. I feel very, very awkward. I would rather deal with debt myself. I would rather take out debt. I would rather not get the things that I wanted. I'd rather not spend. I'd rather find ways to save. I don't think I've taken any money off anyone since I was 18 years old. And I'm not saying that's a badge of honor, but I wouldn't even ask family for money because I do know it causes trouble, man. People, you know, if you don't owe someone money, and I'm not talking about the bank or, you know, because we all have debts to pay on cars or on houses. That's everybody's got that. And you don't really, you don't feel bad about the bank when you borrow more or you pay some back or whatever. You never like pay that bank back and then say, oh, well, let me take my banker out for lunch because I managed to put an extra $5,000 in. Bullshit. But with your family and friends, that's a whole different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I've seen as well is I had, like, I think it was my sister's friend, and she borrowed her, like, a large sum of money. But this was to start a business. So yep. This is, the friend is like, I want to start a business, and here's the money. And they gave her the money, and this person then blew it. They did not start the business. And what actually ended the friendship was not the fact that they took that money. It was the fact that I gave you money to do something with your life and you didn't do that. And that's what ended our friendship. I don't care about you paying it back, but you lied to me and you deceived me. So therefore, I can't be your friend anymore. And I think that's what also ends a lot of friendship. It's not the fact that I gave you the 1,000 rand, the 500. It's the fact that you deceived me in the I'll pay you back.
Yeah.
Or you keep saying every 3 months. Yeah, every 3 months. And it's like, dude, but now you're lying. And how do I trust your word? How do I trust you?
The other thing nobody talks about is when you go into business with somebody, and this is often a problem. You know, like when you haven't got those contracts signed and you think you're the half owner of a business and they tell you that you're half and half, whatever. You find out down the way, suddenly you're responsible for half the debts and that person has taken out half the money. And you're like, whoa, what's happened here? And this happens in South Africa all the time. And I'm not talking about big corporate deals. I'm talking about like two people who start a little corner shop together where they're selling stuff like a vendor. You're selling stuff from a caravan, basically. And you say, all right, I'll go and buy the stock. Your friend says to you, cool, I'll sell it. Friend sells the stock and pockets the money, and you end up like out of pocket for all of that stock. This has happened. I heard stories like this just last week. And I'll tell you what, it's not easy to come out of that and not be resentful and angry. If you're going to do these with your friends, please do it properly. Get a lawyer or get someone to witness it. Sign an agreement together. Handle it professionally, because all of that friendship is gone like that if you don't do it properly from the beginning.
Especially when you felt like you could trust the person. When you thought, no, man, like Mash and I, we good for it. And then Mash is the one, when it's time for the profits, they're like, yeah, it's 60-40. Huh? When was it 60-40? I thought it was a 50-50. And then you realize, when it comes to money, you don't actually know people. You don't.
When it comes to business, that's where you have to actually go the legal route. You have to have paperwork in place. You can't just say, here's 50,000, let's see what you do with it. You can't do that when it comes to business, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I do like Mash's idea, Mash the Mashonisa, of like take something as collateral. say to someone, I'll have your iPad until you pay me back.
That is so gangster. That is so. That sounds like something my grandmother would do. Let me tell you, my grandmother told me that if you ever have tenant issues, right? And in SA, the laws are very protective over the tenant. They're like, just go unscrew the door there, and you take the door and walk away. You'll be fine.
That's what my friend did to her tenant. That's what my friend did to her tenant. The same friend who gave me this advice did that to a tenant. Yeah.
This friend of yours, I want this friend of yours. She sounds like she needs to be our financial advisor on the show. I bet you she also knows how to save money on petrol and electricity. This is somebody we need to talk
to.
She
really does.
She sounds hardcore, man. So she unscrewed the door.
Yeah, I mean,
hey, can you imagine doing that during winter? Imagine.
Yeah, and you walk away. You don't. They say you don't even make a fuss. You just take the door with you. You get... It gets onto the truck. You are gone. You're not saying anything to anyone. They're like, come back in 2 days. People are gone. They're gone.
She did that, and the tenant was out of town. And then when the tenant came back on Sunday, there was no door. And then she was calling, she was frantic. And she was like, yeah, pay your rent and I'll bring back your door. Pay your rent and your door will be reinstalled. And it actually worked because this tenant did actually pay their rent. So it actually did work. They were 3 months behind. So they paid all 3 months in one go.
So they had the money all along.
You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's the only way. And this friend also took another friend's car. So the other friend was actually driving a BMW. She took his car, gave him money, gave back the money, gave him his car back. That's the only way to do things.
That's insane. All right. So
you guys are living in another world.
we got to talk to Dr. Anne Bickard, a medical doctor who works in Johannesburg, lives with her partner in a small farm where they provide a home to rescued greyhounds. That's just some behind the scenes info. She's written an incredible book, which I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed paging through this and reading little bits and pieces, called Holding My Breath, Further Exploits of an ER Doctor. It's a candid, heartbreaking, and very funny memoir in the life of one of Johannesburg's busiest emergency rooms. Her warmth and humanity shine through when often harrowing tales, creating an unputdownable, uplifting, and inspiring book are all written out. And this is incredible. And we're going to speak to Dr. Anne Bickard now. We're not going to go on video with Dr. Bickard because probably, like half the country at the moment, there's load shedding, but we do want to hear her clearly. So, Doctor, very nice to have you back on the show. It's been a while. The last time we spoke to you, we enjoyed it so much we thought we had to have you back. And the excuse that you'd written a book is just the perfect reason to get you back. How are you?
I'm good, good. How are you guys?
Extremely well. Yeah. So, Doc, first of all, this isn't your first book, and it's great to see that you've managed, despite having a very, very busy life and some incredible adventures as a medical doctor, it's great to see that you've had the time to write another book. This is terrific stuff. What actually made you decide to do it? Because the first one was so popular?
Yeah, I think people enjoyed the first one. I had very positive feedback. And the books are about ED, so I'm still working in the ED. So I guess I've still got more stories to tell. So I just kept on writing.
So listen, it's hard for people who are not in the emergency room all the time to know what goes on in there. And sometimes you hear stories. I've got friends who are doctors and I hear stories and I actually am not sure that they're telling the truth. But South Africa's emergency rooms must be some of the most exciting places in the whole world. And there must be a massive amount of adrenaline that runs through your system every time you walk in there to report for duty. You never know what you're going to get. And it's such a mixed bag. And we are such a strange country. You honestly don't know what's going to come through those doors. And you have to be prepared for anything, right?
Exactly. I mean, literally anything can come through the doors. And South Africa's a really mixed bag, as you say. And quite a lot of people have asked me, you know, throughout both of the books, there are many sort of cameos of different people that I've met and different situations. And quite a lot of people have asked me, you know, how do you make all this stuff up? And the truth is, I don't make it up. It's all true. But, you know, it's mixed up a bit in terms of gender and age and timing and some other details so that people don't recognize themselves. But all the stories are absolutely true in one form or another. So, yeah, you get some really strange people. You get some really funny situations. You get some absolute tragedies. Just the other day, we had a set of workers who were trying to fix a petrol tanker, and they thought they'd do a little bit of welding on the body of the petrol tanker. Didn't end too well.
Jesus, I'm sure that was carnage.
Proper blast injury like you see in the military, you know? Mm. So there's always excitement. You never know what's coming in next.
So, Doc, obviously, I've spoken to a lot of my friends who are doctors. Their favorite time of year if they work in emergency rooms is New Year, because there's always a huge amount of chaos, drunkenness, stupidity, particularly in Johannesburg. We seem to have this it's like a tradition now of doing the dumbest things you can on New Year's Eve. Are you trying to actively avoid these situations because you know when the real trouble comes? And obviously you don't know, because it could be a Tuesday afternoon and you could end up with something really crazy, chaotic and terrible. But are there certain days and times that you know that the emergency room is just going to be overflowing?
Well, Sundays are always busy. I mean, Sundays are sort of a mixture between sport and sort of, as you say, people just going out and drinking too much on Saturday night and doing things. I have to say lockdown was pretty incredible because I worked New Year's Eve during lockdown, not this past one, the one before. And it was a very unusual New Year's Eve in that we didn't have any sort of alcohol-related things. We had, you know, trauma from people falling off balconies and dislocating their shoulders and things like that, but none of those people were really under the influence of alcohol. So lockdown really had a huge effect on that. I mean, that really did decrease the numbers in the trauma unit. But most, like, EDs, the ED that I work in is a mixed ED, so anyone can kind of come through the door. I mean, we can have medical cases, heart attacks, pediatrics, trauma, whatever happens to be happening. Whereas the bigger hospitals like Barrow split their ED into what's called trauma, which is motor vehicle accidents, gunshots, stabbings, and then medical emergencies, because it's actually just too busy and too ungainly to have them all coming to one place. So, yeah, the trauma unit at Barrow on New Year's Eve is a place where you're going to learn to do every procedure you need to know for the rest of your life.
I'm sure for a doctor who you have to be really made of strong stuff to be in the emergency department, but for a doctor who wants to experience it all, who really wants to test their mettle and see whether they can handle anything that the world throws at them, South Africa has to be a great place for those kinds of doctors. And there are obviously very few people who have the mettle to actually make it through you know, enough of the time that you've spent in an emergency room in South Africa. And especially when you are these mixed sort of cases where, you know, at one point it could be these very, very difficult, very dangerous things. And you also don't know what kind of people you're dealing with. Sometimes they're high, sometimes they're drunk, sometimes they are dangerous people. And then you have to treat them. Sometimes you have to treat criminals. Sometimes you have to treat children. Must be very, very difficult to do that. The kids must be the worst part.
Yeah, kids are really tough to deal with, especially small, you know, toddlers and babies with serious illnesses. And obviously their parents are distraught, which makes it, you know, it's quite difficult to keep a steady hand, because when everybody's screaming and shouting, it's quite hard to remain calm, you know. But that is definitely something that you learn. And I think, you know, when you're saying that it's a good place to, say, work on a New Year's Eve, certainly almost all hospitals in South Africa will put their senior doctors on, and if they have consultants in the unit, they'll be available. So we've got a great system like that. The consultants in government and the senior doctors in private put themselves forward for the time or be needed. So you put a junior doctor and senior on shift. You wouldn't leave somebody who's just qualified alone on Christmas Day, for argument's sake, because, you know, GP's rooms are closed. People are more likely to be playing sport, getting themselves into difficulties, choking on peanuts, whatever, than they would be normal work to make sure that junior people on their own in the line of fire. And also anticipate, because don't forget that the doctor who's covering the ED after hours is the only doctor in the hospital. So if you have an emergency, say in ICU, where a patient deteriorates, that doctor has to go to ICU and stabilize the patient, which is often very difficult because they've got complicated medical histories. There's often, you know, reason why they've deteriorated, and it might not be your area of speciality. You know, if the patient's had surgery or...
You certainly have to learn on the job. I mean, that's a really, really...
Whatever, you know, so...
Doc?
You have to... I mean, obviously those...
It was just
the attending doctors are available on the phone.
It was just breaking up quite badly. Can we get to the funny ones? Because I know that this is a serious thing, and being a doctor, you honestly deal with life and death in a way that most of us in our jobs just have no comprehension for. But there are hilarious and ridiculous things that happen all the time, and this is a large part of the book. And some of these stories are just, they are unbelievable. And like you said, so many of your friends will say, "How do you make this stuff up?" But honestly, your favorite stories, and you don't have to give away too many of them because I want people to buy your book and actually read them for themselves and hear it as you write it because you write it beautifully. But what are your favorite stories? I mean, like, what are the funniest things that have happened to you, especially recently and during lockdown when people were already behaving strangely?
I think some of the strangest things are where people either don't want to actually consult with you, but they want your opinion. So they're in the car, you know, and if you haven't got the mileage to say, you know, look, I'm sorry, but I actually don't consult in the car park. Obviously, if someone's desperately ill, we'll come to the car park and get the person, you know. But if they want to sit in the car and want me to come there to consult, then I sort of draw the line. So I had a couple who kept appearing in the ambulance bay and beckoning us out to the car park and then locking the windows and doors so that I could speak to them. They were a classic couple. It turned out that the lady had taken an overdose of sleeping tablets. Which of course they denied until I'd done the blood test. But you know, they really made me scratch my head. I was like, what is going on here? You know, I had a guy who told me that his nipple had moved from the chest to his armpit. He obviously was taking mind-altering substances, which he admitted. You know, just anything from literally rescuing bits of Lego up people's noses to having to put in chest drains on people who've fallen roof, you know, lots of things. Anything can happen.
Well, people put funny
and you've either got to laugh.
People put funny things into various orifices. I mean, I've also heard horror stories from other doctors that I know about stuff that they've had to help extract from people who've been involved in all kinds of crazy, whether it's sex play or I don't know, like a game of truth or dare that goes wrong, but people end up with rather embarrassing objects inside of them. And this is always hilarious. And you doctors have to obviously maintain a sense of decorum and dignity while you're trying to remove these things. Sometimes it must be hilarious. Do you ever find yourself kind of half breaking into laughter and then holding it back?
Well, I think I've sort of been in the game long enough to really nothing surprises me. So I had a chap who'd lost the purchase, call it, on his tomato sauce bottle that had ended up per rectum, as we say. And he had a long story about how he'd lost the
so
he had to climb through the pantry window and the bottle just went up there. And I listened to the whole story and I kept an absolutely straight face. And I said, so why were you naked? And he just stared at me and his whole story just was completely cut, you know, in that moment. And then I just sort of said, matter, you know, the worst thing for him was that he was not with his wife. So now we have to think up some story to tell his wife why he had to go for an operation.
Oh, wow.
Because he couldn't tell her the truth, you know. And we also can't obviously actually lie.
Yeah.
And he was such a sort of meek, mild-mannered guy. You would never ever have that. So, yeah, and I had a guy tied a stack sticking out of his mouth. Very sadly came to the casualty looking all sheepish. So people do very strange things. They think it's a good, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time, let's say.
Yeah, and people, the resilience of the human body is quite something. I know that we often think how fragile and kind of on the knife's edge we are as living creatures because our bodies are susceptible to all kinds of damage from the outside world and sometimes self-inflicted damage. But really, the resilience of the human body is something quite extraordinary, and especially in children and, funnily enough, in drunk people, they seem to be able to rally round from just about anything. I mean, you must have seen some people who you thought were goners who've pulled through, and even you must have been surprised sometimes.
You know, the resilience is high, but we call it the golden hour in trauma. Basically, if you can get to somebody, even with a very serious injury, with of saving them. The problem is once they start to, once they start to kind of deteriorate beyond that golden hour, that is probably one of the most scary things about work, because you can see what's going to happen. You can see the track that they're going on, and you see the signs before it happens. So I had a trauma patient the other day that everybody was very, very relaxed about, and I was like, no, 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 there's something else going on here. And the patient was fine. His blood pressure was okay, and he was talking to us. And then I sort of glanced at the younger doctor I was working with. When the patient starts to sweat, you start to sweat. That's the first sign that things are going to go wrong. And you've got like 10 minutes. So people are resilient, but once they start to decompensate, it goes pear-shaped really quickly. And it's actually quite terrifying seeing it. You can sort of almost see where the train's going to go off the tracks, but you can't stop it, you know?
So what was actually
you know,
wrong
with that guy? He had an internal bleed.
Oh, okay. Because, I was just wondering what it was.
So he was a really interesting guy. He had a bleed, an internal bleed, but it was in his duodenum. So he didn't have any symptoms. So he hadn't vomited blood and he hadn't passed blood. So I could see that he was very pale and that his heart was racing. But he couldn't give me any history of bleeding from anywhere. And he was normal. His, you know, his X-rays, his ultrasound was normal because I couldn't see the blood. It was inside his duodenum.
Yeah.
And he was bleeding out. I mean, basically, you know, right in front of me. And his heart was getting faster and faster. And his blood pressure was getting lower. And I couldn't get to the bottom of what the problem was. And obviously, you have to know what you have to fix before you can. A thing called urea, which you actually looking whether they're dehydrated, but if you bleed into your gut, you reabsorb that the blood in the form of urea. And so an absolutely classical thing is a young guy with a normal everything else and then a very raised urea is basically an internal bleed. So I phoned the surgeon in a panic and he was like, what do you want me to take this guy to theater now without any symptoms?
Mm-hmm.
And if he hadn't taken him in those like 20 minutes, that guy would have been. And he was a really nice guy. He had these like really green eyes. I called him the Cheshire Cat in my book. And the Cheshire Cat was, you know, he was like, who's this man? I was like, he's the cardiologist. He's like, oh. I said, I got him specially for you. He said, thank you. He was such a polite man. He says, who's this man? I said, he's the surgeon. He's oh, why do I need a surgeon? I'm trying to save your life here, you know. He was very nice. He's fine, very nice. But as he got paler, his eyes got greener.
Sure. You know, these life and death situations, these
more and more tissue.
These situations must be really, really extraordinary. And when they work out and when you are able to save a life, it must be put you on a bit of a high. Simultaneously, the ones that don't work out so well must affect you, even if you're the strongest and most stoic doctor that there is. So how do you handle that stuff, doctor, when you have so many highs and lows in any given day and you have to maintain your composure and you have to focus on the task at hand? What do you do to decompress? What kind of things can you put into your life? And I'm sure that this would count for many of us who think that we're stressed. How do you manage these things from a personal, psychological and emotional point of view?
Well, I think the first thing is, in both of the books, I talk a lot about my relationship with the Grim Reaper, who I call Grim.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow he's sort of on the left and I'm on the right of the scoreboard. I don't know why that is. Also don't know why he's a man and not a woman. But he gets, you know, if he gets a point or I get a point, it's almost like a tussle. You know, he's always going to win in the end, obviously. But we, like that guy, Cheshire, I got him back from Grim. Grim was, had him, boy. He was towing him out the roof. And I hung on and managed to get a point on the. So it's almost like you. It's not a game. I mean, clearly it's somebody's life, but you have to have some kind of sense that you're in it to win it, you know?
Right.
And that you have agency in it in a way, rather than that you're just a sort of victim of what comes through the door. And then I guess there are two other things. I exercise quite a lot, which I think is really important, because if you can come home and go for a run or go to the gym or ride a horse or whatever, it kind of erases a lot of the trauma of the day, and you can sit down in the evening and you feel like you are not totally tied to the chaos of the day.
Yeah.
And the last thing is to traumatize everybody around you with what horrors have crossed your path. Because I do think that that must quite a lot of secondary trauma to the families of people who work in EDs or have, say, worked over COVID and come home with all these terrible stories and, like, secondarily traumatize everybody around them. So I try not to do that.
You know, Tracy brings up a question here, and I do want Mash and Simpiwe to ask you a couple of things if they've got questions too. But Tracy says the worst for a doctor is when a patient comes in and says, I've Googled these symptoms and... do you have that happen often? I mean, not obviously not in trauma, because people usually don't have time to Google things, or if they have, they're quite aware of their situation already in trauma. They just don't want to admit it to you sometimes. Does it irritate you when people try and self-diagnose ordinary people? They go on Google, they think they've got brain cancer when actually they've just got a headache?
I wouldn't say it irritates me. I'll joke with them about it and say, you know, yeah, well, Google will tell you the worst things. You know, that's not always what's wrong with you. So, but sometimes people bring up things that are quite interesting. And I mean, it's something that I used to do. I mean, strangely enough, can you believe when I was at medical school, there was no such thing as Google. But I'd often say to patients, what do you think is wrong with you? Because they often won't say, you know, they know somebody who, for argument's sake, they had a brain tumor, now they've got a headache. Yeah. So they're actually worried they have a brain tumor. It sounds silly to say, I'm worried I've got a brain tumor. So if I ask them what they are worried about, then we can resolve that, right, you know, and bring it to light and examine it and say, well, you know, this fits or that doesn't fit, or, you know, so take them seriously, you know. And sometimes people tell me they Google things and I'll go and Google it and say, wow, I've never heard of that. That's interesting. Sure. Yeah, there's always stuff to learn. Google knows a lot more than I do. Wikipedia is a great source of information about bizarre illnesses, you know?
Yeah. What are they? WebMD.
Yeah. I still find Wikipedia one of the best ones, but I have got a few apps on my phone to look things up and, you know, yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, you can't know everything.
No,
and
sure.
You can't remember everything, you know?
Sure.
That was interesting when I worked in the UK because, you know, there I'm a foreigner, you know, so they think I don't know what I'm doing. Here, yeah. If I don't know what I'm doing, I'll take out my phone or take out a reference book and look up the dose. But there you can't do that because you're aware that everybody's watching you. So, you know, in the middle of a recess, I say, I just have to go to the bathroom. My sisters are like, what? You're going to the bathroom when you're doing CPR, you know? And I quickly, like, page through the book and then I come out all calm with the drug doses at hand, you know? Because you can't remember. I mean, if you have somebody with a bizarre condition, you have to look up how much of medication to get.
Yeah, that's
don't make a mistake because you're too proud.
That's so human because, I mean, we think doctors are superhuman and they're not. They also forget stuff. They also get things wrong occasionally. It's not always so easy for you, especially in a stressful situation, to remember everything.
Yeah, I mean, I was teaching a student the other day and I said, well, I actually don't know the answer to that question, but the good thing is I know who to ask.
Mm.
You know, that's and I know when to ask. That's the other important. If you're not coping, call for help.
Right.
You know, don't pretend, you know.
Simpiwe and Mash, you've got some questions, I'm sure, for Dr. Anne Bacard.
Yes,
I do. Can I go first?
Go, right. Simpiwe, go. And this is not a free consultation.
I'm an avid, like, Grey's Anatomy watcher. Like, I love it. And some of the surgeries and operations can just be out of this world. So I'm interested to know, have you ever had, like, those crazy moments where there's a patient and you're like, stapler, scissors, and there's something that you had to do that's kind of not orthodox?
So, yeah, I've never watched Grey's Anatomy, so I can't comment on what they do there. I have had some pretty crazy. A little while ago, I had a patient who had a huge bleed in their brain. It was a young man. He had a thing called a perianeurism. It's an unusual kind of a weakness in your vessel, and the vessel bursts and it bleeds rapidly because it's an artery. Sorry, I hope I don't have COVID.
No, I hope not too.
You just have to buzz at work now. They'd be pursuing me with one of the.
You know, Doc, there was a moment not so long ago where if you joked about COVID like that, people wouldn't laugh. Now we find it funny again.
Well, yeah, I sort of had a bit of a hoarse throat. The sisters were following around yesterday saying, shouldn't you have a COVID test, doctor? I'm like, no, you're going to charge me for that test. Go away.
So yes, you were saying these unorthodox operations.
Yeah. So he came in and they'd found him unresponsive at home. And I kind of looked at him and I was like, no, there's like, this guy's really in trouble here. And he's completely unconscious, but he's a young guy. So we intubated him, ventilator, rushed him down for a scan, and he's got this massive bleed. So I phoned the neurosurgeon who happened to be in the hospital. And I said to him, can you come right now? Because now, there's nothing I can do about it. And he said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, I want you to drill a hole in his head to let the blood out. He said, what, you want me to do that in the casualty? I was like, yeah, it's like urgent. So he said, okay. So he got his equipment from the theater and he came running along to casualty and we drilled a hole in the guy's head and let the blood out. It was absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal.
That's incredible. Now, how did you know where to drill the hole?
So he showed me, he said, you take like the center of the pupil on the side where there's a bleed. I'd done a CT scan, so I knew there was a bleed. You'd go from the center of the pupil 12 centimeters. He'd like marked it out for me, and then he proceeded. I mean, I've seen that once in government in trauma, but like
so was
30
that,
years ago.
I mean, was that on the temporal lobe? I mean, was that on the side of, just above the cheek?
If you go straight up from the pupil onto the top of the head, through the eyebrow, 12 centimeters up from the pupil.
Oh, wow. Okay, so right there on the forehead. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Sure.
It was as I did ask him how he decided, and then I was like, not like I'm intending on doing this with Archie here, but
that's
you know,
amazing.
Just in case.
Well, you don't want to go too deep because you can then hit the brain itself. But I mean, this is detailed. What kind of drill do they use there, Doc?
He's got like a special drill. It's like a neurosurgery drill. It's very neat. It's got like a special thing that kind of it only drills with like bone in front of it. It kind of stops itself when it reaches soft tissue.
Wow. Okay, that's incredible. Mash, I know you've got something you want to know, and we've only got like 5 seconds left with the doc, so go ahead.
All right, quick one, Dr. Anne. I just want to find out, with all the trauma that you deal with on a day-to-day basis, all the people that you see 1 minute, they're alive, they're well, and then 10 minutes later, they're no longer with us. How do you actually do some self-care? How do you actually go about dealing with this and actually keeping positive after witnessing all of this on a day-to-day basis?
So a lot of people ask us whether we have like post-traumatic stress counseling and that kind of thing. And I think certainly if you work in a busy unit, you actually, in a way, your defenses are functional. So you can't, you know, if you have, say, an unsuccessful resuscitation of a toddler that drowns, which is probably one of the most stressful things that happens, you have to speak to the family and you know you're just going to like decimate their lives and there actually aren't any words to say. Really awful. In a way, it's easier not to talk about it because if you go down that road of, you know, if only I'd checked 5 minutes earlier, once you go down that road with the patient, it's you're going down a rabbit hole, you know, so you can only say you're sorry and get them the support that you can get them and then pick up the next file because otherwise, if you go down that rabbit hole, I don't think you're ever going to come out. And it's the same with COVID. Just, you had to just keep going because you were unsuccessful with some people, but there was always somebody else to help, you know?
Well, I mean,
and if you let
Doc, there must be books written in the 17 and 1800s by battlefield surgeons where they were literally sawing and chopping off limbs on an hour by hour basis. And they seem to have got on with it and carried on living and making themselves useful both on the battlefield and back in private practice when they got back to the city that they came from. I mean, you know, we think about it. At least we can do it inside of hospitals where things are a little more sterile, things are a little more controlled, you have the equipment at hand, and we know a huge amount more than they did obviously in the 1800s.
Yeah, I think the important thing with COVID was that we began to feel helpless. And that was very difficult for the medical profession, you know, because we've always kind of had kind of special powers and you know, sort of ways to get well thought out strategies and whispers and secrets and spells, you know, that we could cast. And, you know, COVID came along and we lost that. We couldn't help our patients. We were like screaming into the wind, you know. And I think that a lot of doctors lost their confidence, lost their sense of self, their sense of usefulness, as you said, the sense that they can do something. And it's been a tough road. I mean, there's no question that everybody that I work with has PTSD far more from the COVID pandemic than, say, from going to help at Hurricane Katrina or something like that, you know?
That's incredible. I would never have guessed that. I'm sure a lot of people are quite surprised to hear that. The book is this one. It is called Holding My Breath, Further Exploits of an ER Doctor by Dr. Anne Bicard. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show this morning. And please keep telling us these stories and keep saving the lives. I hope the Grim Reaper, Grim, doesn't get ahead of you on the scoreboard for at least the next few years. We've got lots of people who need the care and consideration of someone with your experience. And it's great to have you as our guest this morning. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you. And thanks so much for inviting me. That was great fun.
Anytime. Always good to see you. Thanks so much. Dr. Anne Bicard. And you can get her book at good bookstores. You can also find it online. Make sure that you check it out. CliffCentral.com. It is 8 o'clock. We will see you tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. Have an awesome day, everybody. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.